This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm Joe Ramsey. Myanmar's foreign ministry on Saturday rejected a UN General Assembly resolution calling for an arms embargo against the Southeast Asian nation and condemning the military's February seizure of power. Myanmar described the measure, which passed Friday and is not legally binding, as being, quote, based on one-sided sweeping allegations and false assumptions. The resolution reflected a broad international consensus condemning the takeover that ousted Aung San Suu Kyi's elected government. It called on the military junta to restore the country's democratic transition, condemned its, quote, excessive and lethal violence since the takeover, and called on all countries to prevent the flow of arms into Myanmar. President Vladimir Putin sought on Saturday to give Russia's ruling party a pre-election boost by promising to spend big on infrastructure, education, and health. Putin also announced his key allies, defense and foreign ministers, would front the campaign for the ruling United Russia Party for September's parliamentary elections. The Russian president's most prominent domestic critic, the jailed Alexei Navalny, and his allies are barred from the elections after they were declared, quote, extremists. Russia's capital, Moscow, on Saturday reported a pandemic high for new coronavirus cases for the second consecutive day, as the city's hospitals are flooded with new patients due to the Delta variant. The city registered more than 9,000 infections in 24 hours, those figures ballooning from 3,000 daily just 2 weeks ago, with Moscow's mayor saying Friday the highly infectious Delta variant first identified in India represents nearly 90% of new cases. Find more on these stories at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Iran's hardline judiciary chief has won the country's presidential election in a landslide victory. Initial results released Saturday propelled Ibrahim Raisi, a protege of the country's supreme leader, into Tehran's highest civilian position. The vote appeared to see the lowest turnout in the Islamic Republic's history. Raisi won nearly 18 million votes in the contest, well ahead of the race's sole moderate candidate. However, Raisi dominated the election only after a panel under the watch of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei disqualified his strongest competition. His candidacy and the sense that the election served more as a coronation for him sparked boycotts and a lack of interest among many eligible voters. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch said Ibrahim Raisi's election as Iran's new president is a blow for human rights. They are also calling for him to be investigated over his role in what Washington and rights groups say is the extrajudicial executions of thousands of political prisoners in 1988. Iran has never acknowledged the mass executions, and Raisi has never publicly addressed allegations about his role. Some clerics have said the trials were fair, praising the, quote, eliminating of armed opposition in the early years of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. The European Union's foreign policy chief told Lebanon's leaders on Saturday they were to blame for the country's political and economic crisis, and some could face sanctions if they continued to obstruct steps to form a new government and implement reform. The EU's Josep Borrell says he was bringing a firm message the country stood on the edge of financial collapse and politicians could not afford to waste more time. He spoke after what he called a, quote, frank exchange with Lebanon's president. The country's currency has lost 90% of its value and more than half of the population are living in poverty and struggling with rampant inflation, power blackouts, and shortages of fuel and food. And India's central government on Saturday urged states to be careful in reopening from COVID-19 lockdowns to prevent a resurgence of infections in the hard-hit country. Indian states are easing restrictions as a second wave of coronavirus infections appears to slow. The country is only behind the United States in confirmed infections at almost 30 million, with more than 385,000 deaths. Since the easing of restrictions, crowds and traffic have filled the streets and cities across India, threatening another spike in infections in the world's second most populous country. The government is telling states to regularly monitor adherence to COVID-19 guidelines, masks, hand hygiene, social distancing, and proper ventilation in closed spaces. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
We have been asking the government to accept this dialogue for 10 years. We have even written papers about that. President Gbagbo himself has urged the government to start this political dialogue for reconciliation.
The party of former Ivorian President Laurent Gbagbo says he is ready to play a role in the country's reconciliation efforts.
Doing an investigation is not, they cannot contest it. They cannot say that we don't have the right to do so. We have the right to do so because it's in accordance with the rules of the Charter. It's in accordance with the rules of procedure. There is no problem on that issue. And it's a small problem. There is no problem for that.
The African Union launches an investigation into allegations of human rights violations in Ethiopia's Tigray region.
We are on firm ground at any given time. And that should give the Zambian people confidence that once they elect us into office, we shall do as we say, because we have not been flip-flopping in terms of our policies, what we propose to implement for the country.
And a Zambian opposition party promises to build memorial libraries for each former Zambian president. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Ivory Coast, the opposition Ivorian Popular Front Party says its leader, former President Laurent Gbagbo, is ready for negotiations with the government as part of the country's reconciliation efforts. Jean-Gervais Tchéidi, vice president of the party, says the former president plans to engage in political activities next week after a much-needed rest and carrying out family commitments. Tchéidi says supporters and leaders of the party have been vindicated by Gbagbo's acquittal at the International Criminal Court and what the party described as his triumphant return to the country. For additional reaction and plans of the former president, I reached Jean-Gervais Tchéidi in Ivory Coast's commercial capital, Abidjan.
Well, as you can guess, I'm very, very happy. I'm even more than happy. Happy about his return to the country. We went to the airport yesterday to welcome him, friendly and very warm. He himself said that he was very happy to see us again.
What was his message to his supporters when he went to the party headquarters after 10 years of being absent from the party headquarters?
Well, he just said that for the time being, he is not going to talk about political affairs. He just decided that he will go to his village where his mother had been buried when he was away. And that was something very, very difficult for him to support. But he will go there to say a few prayers on his mother's grave. And after that, he will also go to say a few words to the graves of other friends of him, of the party, exactly, especially Mr. Sangare Abdourahmane. He's a friend and brother. And after that, he will go to the party and say that he is now ready to work for the party. So for the time being, we are not going to see him in political action. Maybe in 1 week, that will be possible.
What does he intend to do regarding the reconciliation of the country? Because some people were worried that his presence in Ivory Coast could cause tension, could cause instability, and could affect efforts to reconcile Ivorians to live in peace.
Well, as a former president and as the leader of an opposition party, what he can do is to make proposals, to make some propositions to the government, because reconciliation is the affair of the government. Nobody in the opposition can do something if the government refuses to follow. So we have all our propositions in terms of reconciliation. They are ready. And our President Gbagbo will repeat those propositions to the government. The major proposition is that to free all the political prisoners, to release them, because it has been 10 years now that we have political prisoners, and this is not acceptable. The exiled, the refugees, or all those people must come back to their country. This is up to the government to do it. And now after that, our main proposition is that we need a national forum of reconciliation in which we will talk as brothers of the same family to make sure that what has happened to the family, I mean to the country, will not happen again. But for that, we need that the government accept this national forum of reconciliation in which political parties, civil society, religious people, everybody will come and we shall talk. And we shall talk freely and sincerely to make sure that we have now understood that crisis is not a condemnation. We can avoid crisis and we can do what needs to be done to avoid those crises, political crises, I mean.
Some people were expressing concern that President Gbagbo's presence in Ivory Coast could threaten the country's peace. Is that the stance? What do you say to those concerns?
Of course, now that he's here, his teammates and all the people, the followers of our party, will be ready to accept reconciliation. If the prisoners are released, if those who have who are still in exile are coming back, in those conditions, they are more ready to come to accept the idea of reconciliation. So his presence in the country will strengthen and will boost this reconciliation process.
Does that mean that your party is ready, led by former President Gbagbo, to have peaceful negotiations and dialogue with the government or perhaps with President Ouattara in terms of this reconciliation process?
Of course. Not only we are ready, but this is what we are hoping. We are expecting the government to accept this reconciliation process, this dialogue. We have been asking the government to accept this dialogue for 10 years. We have even written papers about that. The President Gbagbo himself has urged the government to start this political dialogue for reconciliation.
Jean Gervais Tshiyide is the vice president of former President Laurent Gbagbo's opposition Ivorian Popular Front Party. He spoke with me from Ivory Coast commercial capital, Abidjan. In Ethiopia, the African Union's Human Rights Commission says the Continental Body's charter enables it to investigate allegations of human rights violations in member countries. Remy Ngoi Lumbu is the deputy chairperson of the African Union's Commission on Human and People's Rights. He says the organization has launched an inquiry into allegations of abuse during the conflict in the Tigray region. But the Ethiopian Foreign Ministry says it was regrettable for the African Union to take a unilateral decision to proceed with its investigation without the country's input. It adds that the AU's decision lacks a legal basis and failed to follow proper procedure. The AU's Human Rights Commission denies the charge. For the latest development in the inquiry into allegations of human rights violations in Tigray, I reach Remy Ngoi Lumbu in the Congolese capital, Kinshasa.
I can confirm you that African Union, through this organ, the African Commissioner for Human and People Rights, has launched today the human rights investigations on the issue of abuses, violation of human rights in Tigray. And you are going to hear from those matters in the 3 months to come, because we are going to work on it sincerely, and we expect that when we are going to finish, we are going to see clearly what is the situation in Tigray now.
The African Union has asked for cooperation from both sides of the conflict, but realistically, do you expect full cooperation? And if one or all of the sides decide not to cooperate, then what's next?
At the end of our press statement, we have asked cooperation for both sides of the conflict, and we are hoping that we are going to get good responses. First of all, we have already good response for the Ethiopian government. As I was saying this morning, they have already given to us the authorization to go in the Tigray region to start our investigations. The problem is that the commission does not have, it seems for the commission that security conditions and the other conditions are not united for the moment so that we can go there. And for the other parties, I don't know what you mean by the other parties, but we are here ready. As you know, some countries that are in the neighboring of Tigray region are already are also involved on those issue of Tigray due to the fact that many refugees and internally displaced persons are in their countries. We are also going to contact them so that they can cooperate with us and work with that to help us to see very well what is happening there. To try to find good responses so that we can stop the abuses of human rights in that region.
The Foreign Ministry of Ethiopia says that this is a unilateral decision taken by the African Union, and it is regrettable. What is your reaction to that?
The decision of starting investigation does not depend on the willingness of governments. So, it cannot be logically unilateral. It's a decision that depends only on the willing of the commission according to the provisions of the charter. You know, you can say that something is unilateral if you need another voice for another voice coming from another person in a contract so that you can say that it is unilateral. We cannot seek any authorizations from any country so that we can do our job. This is what they call us, an independent organ. We are independent because we cannot receive an order coming from even a head of state, even a prime minister inside the 55 countries in Africa. This is what says the rules, and this is what says the charter, and this is what says the rules of procedure of the African Commission of Human and People Rights.
But Mr. Lumbo, according to the Foreign Ministry of Ethiopia, your commission's inquiry, which is completely outside the scope of the invitation by the government of Ethiopia, they said, lacks a legal basis for which this inquiry will be conducted. What is your response to that?
We have a legal basis. If you read the charter, you take the rule 45, you will find the legal basis there. There is no problem. The rule 45, 46... we'll find the legal basis there. You know, the charter gives to the African Commission of Human and People Rights the possibility to initiate investigation then when there is allegation of mass and grave violation of human rights in a country. There is a legal basis. Do you think that an organ like the African Commission of Human and People Rights, 30 years old, can start working on those kind of issues, investigations of human rights, without having any legal basis? It's unbelievable. They know it. They know that we have a legal basis. You know, the fact of doing an investigation is not, they cannot contest it. They cannot say that we don't have the right to do so. We have the right to do so because it's in accordance with the rules of the charter. It's in accordance with the rules of procedure. There is no problem on that issue. And it's a small problem. There is no problem for that.
Remy Ngoyi Lumbu is the deputy chairperson of the African Union's Commission on Human and People's Rights. He spoke with me from the Congolese capital, Kinshasa. In Uganda, the National Unity Platform, or NUP, is calling for the immediate and unconditional release of its supporters who are currently detained by the security services and the police. This after over a dozen of the party's supporters were released on bail. The party says its supporters narrated harrowing experiences of torture and gross human rights violations while in detention. The NUP says charges are trumped up and politically motivated. The police reject the accusations as without merit. Some supporters were arrested during the recent general election, while others were detained after clashes with the security agencies, including the police. Attorney Joel Senyonyi is a parliamentarian and spokesperson for the Ugandan Opposition Party, NUP. He tells me that it is unacceptable for its supporters to be arrested for choosing presidential candidate Robert Kyagulanyi or Bobi Wine over President Yoweri Museveni during the recent elections.
Thanks to the rigorous work of our legal team and, of course, advocacy by several Ugandans, you know, have been calling for the release of these people. We have had a number of them released. Some have been held for more than half a year, others 8 months. But there's still several others that are still being held, many of them on trumped up charges. You know, they are literally political prisoners. They were arrested simply because they support Honorable Kyagulanyi, Bobi Wine, and not Mr. Museveni. We are still demanding that all these political prisoners be released because they have not committed any offense. Supporting Bobi Wine is not an offense.
For those who were released, granted bail, have they shared their experiences of how things went while they were detained?
Oh, yes, it's been a gruesome experience, you know, because they've been packed in these jails. I find they are put in small rooms and they're packed therein like logs. They can't turn as they sleep and so on. The hygiene conditions in the jail cells are terrible. Many of them are actually sick. They are unwell, so we've had to take them to hospital to get treatment and so on. Some were beaten badly. And all forms of torture that happened, that were meted out on these people. So it's a sigh of relief that they're out, but we still have many others that are still being held, and we are demanding that they all get released.
But Joel, some people are expressing concern that it is the opposition, the biggest opposition in Uganda, that is to blame for these individuals causing problems, attacking police, and that is why the security operatives have to react and enforce law and order. How do you respond to that?
So many times when the government is put to the task to explain the arrests of these people, that's the excuse that they use. But we keep saying, look, we are law-abiding citizens. None of us is above the law. So if you think anybody has committed an offense, for starters, why don't you produce them in courts of law? There's no evidence that has been produced. All these ones, after months of being detained and tortured and so on, there's no evidence to prove the allegations. Because if you can prove that somebody has committed an offense, that's okay, because none of us is above the law. If you can prove that I've committed an offense, do so within the courts of law. But they're not able to do that.
Talk to me about efforts the NUP is embarking upon to help the government to limit the spread of the coronavirus, because some people are expressing concern that NUP is violating the COVID-19 protocols implemented to help limit the spread of the disease in Uganda.
So, sadly, COVID-19 has been used as an excuse to persecute the opposition in this country. They kept implementing this election selectively. Once it was something like, even on the day he got nominated, many people lined up across the road. Of course, they were put there, given t-shirts and given money. There were so many of them violating, you know, the COVID SOPs. None of them was touched. This watchdog had actually protected them. When Mr. Museveni and several of his candidates for parliamentary and so on, whenever they were campaigning out there. But when any of us in the opposition, there were 10 people around us, police and the military would come, beat them up, arrest them, and so on. So it was clear that COVID-19 was used as an excuse to persecute us and keep Bobi Wine supporters.
So moving forward, how will the NUP behave, or how would NUP react with this latest lockdown imposed by the government?
Well, of course, what's important is that we must keep safe. We don't want COVID-19 to spread, and that's very important. We have encouraged people to wear their masks, keep the social distancing, and so on and so forth. But our call on government has been, they've used COVID-19 to steal taxpayers' money, plenty of money that was allocated by our parliament. The Auditor General noted that in his report, and up to now, we have not had people brought to book in regards to these matters. And so it is clear they have used it to steal taxpayers' money. They have used it to clamp down on the opposition, etc., etc. And for us, we are saying, yes, COVID is real, but it is sad that our government uses it for its own end.
Attorney Joel Senyonyi is a parliamentarian and spokesperson for the Ugandan opposition party, the NUP. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. In Namibia, an infectious disease specialist is calling for the immediate mass vaccination of the population, coupled with a lockdown to limit the spread of the coronavirus in the southern African country. Dr. Gordon Cupido says the sudden sharp rise of infections is overwhelming both state-funded hospitals and private healthcare delivery systems. His remarks follow reports the government faces shortages of oxygen in healthcare centers. This after the administration in Windhoek imposed new measures aimed at limiting the spread of the disease. Some health experts say conspiracy theories about the coronavirus and the vaccine are impeding efforts to contain the disease. For more on the current situation, I reached Namibian infectious disease expert Dr. Gordon Cupido in the country's capital, Windhoek.
The situation is dire. The infections are increasing daily exponentially and already at a record rate. And with infections comes the toll of people falling ill and requiring hospitalization. Thus far, all the private and public hospitals in Namibia have reached and exceeded the capacity for COVID patients. The state hospital is recruiting nurses, opening up wards, discharging patients in trying to meet the challenge, but the capacity cannot reach this rapid rise.
Why is this so? I understand the government made efforts to educate people and all that, but it appears not to be effective. What is the problem?
I think one of the problems potentially is the nature of the virus. We suspect that we're dealing with a variant, possibly the South African variant, which is more transmissible, more infectious, and possibly makes people more sick. The other problem is that the nature of our settlements, people live in small houses, there's significant overcrowding. And since the last lockdown, it is true that public behavior has been, you know, people have congregated at meeting points, at bars, in churches, funerals, as, you know, as it was before. But the absence of a strong government mandated enforced restrictions or even a lockdown means that people have drifted back to their previous behavior. And this is, of course, what has caused the virus to spread this as a new variant, a vulnerable population with no immunity and very lax regulations has caused this explosion.
What do you think has been the impact of the announcement that both the president and the first lady also contracted the disease or tested positive to the disease?
Did not have a major impact. The news was widely carried, but it did not have an impact. They both survived. They both well. You know, 30, 40 deaths per day in a population of 1.2 million is still apparently not enough to change people's behavior. So I think only massive casualties will really either have an impact or government mandated, government enforced regulations, you know, will be able to turn things around. Two things work: vaccination and lockdown.
Apart from what you have said, what do you think can be done in order to combat this disease seriously? Because I heard a lot of people are still believing in conspiracy theories. They are refusing to take vaccine or not making themselves available to take the vaccine. What's the way forward to limit the spread of the disease?
Like I said, the only proven way is mass vaccination. And second to mass vaccination is mass information. Consistent messaging from credible sources on a constant basis is going to inculcate the message that this is a serious situation, that the virus is deadly, and that vaccination and social measures are the only things which will reduce the spread. And thirdly, you know, social measures up to the point of lockdowns, I think those are the things which are going to slow down eventually the spread of this disease. And since we don't have vaccinations now, and since our caseload is careening upwards at a dizzying height, and dosing rate. I think a lockdown is what is required now.
Dr. Gordon Kopido is an infectious disease expert in Namibia. He spoke with me from the capital, Vinto. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Tanzania has asked to join the COVAX Global Vaccine Sharing Facility and start its first coronavirus immunization campaign more than 15 months after the start of the pandemic. The new policy is a major departure from the policies of late President John Magufuli, who denied coronavirus existed in Tanzania and dismissed the vaccines as dangerous. For VOA, Charles Kombe reports from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam.
In a news conference Thursday, the World Health Organization's regional director in Africa, Mashidiso Moeti, said Tanzania is now formally working to join the COVAX facility. Speaking with the BBC, Tanzanian government spokesperson Gerson Msigwa neither denied nor confirmed the information, but added the government will release an official statement of vaccines at the appropriate time. Rights activist Tito Magoti said this is a good first step towards fighting the pandemic. He says it is a move that some of us Tanzanians were demanding. We are now getting a chance to have a peace of mind because we have been given choices that we are not able to get due to the denial of the government on the issues, he says. Tito added, it is high time now for the government to intensify the issue of coronavirus because there has not been transparency on the issue of updates and measures. It is difficult to gauge the clear extent of coronavirus in Tanzania, as the country stopped reporting data in April 2020 after it had recorded 509 COVID-19 cases and 16 deaths. But overcoming the late president's claim that the virus did not exist in Tanzania and that vaccines were ineffective is still a challenge. Some citizens like Umi Matinde are worried about the efficacy of the vaccines.
Wakati wa uongozi wa mheshimiwa au hayati marehemu Joseph Pombe Magufuli.
She says during the leadership of the late John Magufuli, he didn't allow the vaccines because he said they had negative outcomes into the human body. And at the leadership of Samia Hassan, she says they are allowing it, but they didn't give out proof that show whether the vaccines are good or not. While Tanzanians await the vaccines, Minister of Health Dorothy Gwajima has insisted people take all necessary precautions against COVID-19, including wearing face masks.
Wizara ya Afya imeshasema hivi. Pima mwenyewe kwenye msongamano au huko kwenye msongamano.
You find people in crowd and they don't wear face masks, she says. I didn't tell you to wear face masks when you are going on your farm or when you are in an area with good circulating air. She says there are areas that have limited air and a crowd, and their people must wear face masks. Finance Minister Mwigulu Nchemba says the government has entered talks with the International Monetary Fund for a $571 million loan to address the economic and social impact of COVID-19.
Mkopo huu ni wa masharti nafuu kwa ajili ya kukabiliana na athari za kiuchumi na kijamii.
He says President Samia met Kristalina Georgieva, executive director of the International Monetary Fund, with a view to strengthening relations on economic and social issues, including the issue of strategies to address the impact of COVID-19, he says. But according to IMF, for the loan to be approved, Tanzania needs to publish updated statistics on prevalence of COVID-19. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
In Zambia, the Opposition Patriots for Economic Progress, or PEP, is promising to build memorial libraries for each former Zambian president. This after the party expressed concern about what it described as the Southern African country's poor record-keeping method. PEP says each of the memorial libraries will contain information of a former president, including all available clothes, videos, pictures, speeches, and any relevant literature. The move, the party adds, seeks to preserve the legacy of each of the country's former heads of state. PEP is, however, coming under criticism for its promises. Critics say the party seeks to score political points and relevance using the death of founding president Dr. Kenneth David Kaunda, whose death was announced Thursday. PEP denies the accusation, which it says is unfounded. Zambians go to the polls on August 12 to choose a new president and parliament. To learn more about PEP's plans, I reach Mulonda Mulenga, spokesperson for the Zambian opposition party.
We believe that each president is unique, and they've added something to the growth of our country in terms of economy, in terms of democracy, the rule of law, legal reform, and various other tenets of the democratic governance. So we do believe that our proposal to build a presidential memorial library for each of our former heads of state would actually go a long way in preserving the legacy of each of our former presidents and ensuring that such a legacy is protected and safeguarded for posterity's sake. It's worth mentioning that our view is that there is usually a lot to learn from each head of state, which can be used to better our governance system. And that can only happen if each of the policy measures, the successes and the mistakes, the failures of each presidency are well documented. That will help future governments to make better quality decisions. And we believe that this is something that is long overdue.
So, Mulenga, how does PEP want to fund this project? Are you going to borrow money to fund this project? Because most people are saying, and financial analysts are saying, that Zambia is broke. So how would you fund this project?
Well, obviously, we are fully cognizant of the fact that our treasury's health is not that good at the moment. But we are not talking about anything monumental here. We are just talking about a presidential memorial library. I don't think constructing, let's say, four presidential memorial libraries, one for each of our former heads of state, would actually dent our treasury. I don't think it's a significant cost.
Bamulenga, some people are suggesting that your party wants to take advantage of the death of the founding president to make this proposal, just to score cheap political points and to be relevant ahead of the elections. How do you respond to that?
Well, as a matter of fact, when you look at the policy reform proposals that the Patriots for Economic Progress makes through our party presidential candidate, Mr. Sean Tembo, you realize that these are not just dreamt policy reforms. These are derived from our party manifesto as a party, and these were generated a long time ago. They've been circulating around for the past 3 years or so. If you look at the promises that we have been publishing in the recent couple of months, you realize that they are dated. And this is not something that was conceived overnight. And we couldn't have, projected that there's going to be the death of a president a day or a month before elections. We couldn't have done that. These policy reforms have been in circulation and they've been on our website and they've been shared for the past 3 or 4 years.
Mulenga, how do you respond to critics who say this is yet another publicity stunt by your presidential candidate and, for that matter, your party and its manifesto?
Of course, people are always going to make some kind of accusations whenever you innovate something that they never thought about. And for us in the Patriots for Economic Progress, we are the pioneers of innovation. The other day, we were quarreling with the main opposition, UPND, because they had stolen an entire paragraph from our manifesto. So, when we come up with innovative ideas like this, obviously some of our political opponents will always try to pour some cold water on them. But the fact remains that we are the pioneers of progressive policies for Zambia, the kind of policies that would propel this country forward, that would put it in its rightful place on the world map.
Why do you think Zambians should believe that this is what you plan to do if they decide to give PEP and your presidential candidate the mandate?
I think the main deciding factor is consistency and integrity. So we have always been consistent since our formation in terms of what we stand for, in terms of the policies that we intend to implement. Some of the policies have been widely accepted, others have been perceived as controversial, but we are consistent, we are firm. We are on firm ground at any given time. And that should give the Zambian people confidence that once they elect us into office, we shall do as we say, because we have not been flip-flopping in terms of our policies, what we propose to implement for the country.
Mulondo Mulenga is the spokesperson for the Zambian Opposition Patriots for Economic Progress, or PEP. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Protesters took to the streets of Cape Town, South Africa last Wednesday. Participants were demonstrating against a mixed-use development that is expected to include the African headquarters of American retail giant Amazon. It's being built on sacred land where the country's first inhabitants, the Khoi and San, fought battles against the Portuguese and Dutch. For VOA, Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town.
The new development will cost 4.5 billion rand, or over 300 million US dollars. Once completed, it will include offices, residential units, and a Khoi and San cultural center. The center was negotiated by the First Nations Collective. Its spokesperson, Zenzile Khoisan, says the group comprises all the main Khoi and San tribes. He says they've been discussing the cultural significance of the land with national government since the African National Congress first took over in 1994, but he says they were ignored.
We decided to engage the developer directly. As a result of that, we're able to secure for ourselves a place in the middle, the very center of this development, which will create an international heritage center, an international cultural praxis center, an international media and communication center, a garden of memory, and the entire 6 kilometers of this site is going to be marked with the narrative of our people. Further to that, all the roads, the pathways inside this place is going to be named after the indigenous Khoi. So essentially what we've secured is a liberated zone in which we have secured victory from the jaws of defeat.
But not all Khoi and San groups see it that way. Tariq Jenkins of the Goringai Kona Kuena Council, who is also a member of the Objecting Observatory Civic Association and part of the protest, says they are prepared to go to court to stop tons of concrete being poured on the land. He says they want it to be declared a World Heritage Site instead.
We have differences of opinion in terms of what can be done on an ancestral sacred heritage site. We find it deeply worrying that anyone would think it's okay to build this kind of development on something that is so sacred. We don't believe that that any sacred site should be subjected to this kind of bulk, and then repurposed in our name as some kind of celebration of the Khoi Khoi and San. This is an Amazon Disneyland that is going to commodify our culture and use some representatives of the Khoi Khoi and San to give the impression that everyone is okay with it, which is a completely false narrative. We've got 50,000 objections. So this false narrative that it's just a handful of people that are objecting is a lie.
On the 19th of April, Cape Town's Mayor Dan Plato released a statement confirming Amazon as the anchor tenant. Plateau says the city has carried out its duties and responsibilities related to the land use application with the highest ethical and legal compliance. He added that the development will result in a vibrant business and residential precinct that will unlock enormous investment and job creation potential. Attempts to reach Amazon failed. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
The World Food Programme warns tens of millions of people, mainly in Africa, are teetering on the brink of famine because of conflict, climate shocks, and economic downturn to the COVID-19 pandemic. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The UN Food Agency estimates more than 270 million people, most of them in Africa and the Middle East, around the world are acutely food insecure, with millions at risk of starving to death. It says the number of people at imminent risk of famine has increased from 34 million last year to 41 million now. Without immediate emergency food aid, World Food Programme spokesman Thompson Feary warns the slightest shock will push those extremely vulnerable people over the cliff into famine. He says more than 500,000 people already are facing famine-like conditions.
These are people in Ethiopia's Tigray region, Madagascar, particularly the southern part, South Sudan, especially now as we are now at the height of the lean season in that country, and Yemen.
Feary says Nigeria and Burkina Faso also are of particular concern because in recent months, pockets of people have been in a state of famine. He says the WFP is mounting the biggest operation in its history to avert the catastrophic situation from taking hold.
WFP is focused on scaling up life-saving food and nutrition assistance to meet the essential needs of those furthest behind, overcoming access challenges, and expanding cash-based transfers with significant scale-ups foreseen across several operations.
Feary says the WFP is targeting its food assistance program to 139 million people in countries at particular risk, including Ethiopia, Lebanon, Afghanistan, Sudan, and Syria. He says the WFP will need $5 billion to carry out the mammoth operation this year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
makosa. You want to get up, yeah, boy.
Just like that.
Oh, sure.
Just like that.
If any, fanny, live, look on our own.
Just like that.
Oh, Yoko.
Just like that.
Baby, give me one more.
Just like that.
Touch me one more.
Just like that.
Jesus. Ijama. Come, let's rock together. Give me bombo.
That was Music from the Continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightland Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor Bill Eagle, Reporter Douglas Impuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a child does not die just because the mother's breasts are dry. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.